clear of the closing doors, please.
Hello and welcome to The Next Stop Is with me, Jane August. This is my podcast where I talk to cool New Yorkers. And today we're talking about seltzer, among other things. I'm joined by Alex Gomberg and Barry Joseph, the team behind the Brooklyn Seltzer Museum. Alex is a fourth generation seltzer man and the vice president of Brooklyn Seltzer Boys, which is the last seltzer factory in New York City. And Barry Joseph is a digital experience innovator and consultant, having worked in nonprofits, museums, and education programs. Barry is also the author of Seltzertopia, The Extraordinary Story of an Ordinary Drink, which I believe is the only comprehensive history of seltzer water, right?
That's right. Cue the sound of seltzer.
Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
So before we get to talking about the museum, I think we should kind of figure out how we got here. So the company started as Gomberg Seltzer Works.
Right. So my great-grandfather started the company in 1953, and he was a seltzer man for many years. And then he kind of got out of the delivery aspect of the building, you know, schlepping those heavy cases of seltzer all over the place. And then he opened up Gomberg Seltzer, which is like a one-stop shop for all the seltzer men to come to and have their bottles filled. Also, the seltzer men picked up glass soda that were, you know, for refill and, you know, deposit bottles. And he was doing that for, you know, many years, until my grandfather and my dad and uncle came in the business. And then in 2012, we opened up Brooklyn Seltzer Boys, which is the delivery company of Gomberg. And now basically everything is just Brooklyn Seltzer Boys these days. And we're just delivering cases of seltzer anywhere we can get to.
So the company existed basically your entire life.
Yeah. I mean, my whole life I'm growing up, you know, going to the factory, seeing the seltzer bottles getting filled, not having any idea I was going to be in the business. I went to school for sport management and then got my master's in higher education. As I graduated, I said, I want to do something kind of on my own. And that's when I created this new company, Brooklyn Seltzer. And we had zero customers. We had zero, you know, customers that we were delivering to. And now we're in, you know, the many hundreds of customers and, you know, home delivery, bars, restaurants, office buildings and stuff like that.
So you never really planned on becoming a seltzer man?
No, not at all. I mean, I thought I was going to work somewhere in sports and kind of it just naturally happened this way. And it's good because I like to have my own business, and I also love the history, you know, fact about it. And people just like the fact that we're still here and we are now the last in all of New York that have these, you know, siphon bottles. You know, we fill the bottles for everybody that gets a seltzer here, and one of only three in the entire country.
Wow.
That do, you know, siphon bottling. And we're really the only ones that do it in the beautiful glass bottles, you know, with the old-fashioned logos and you know, from many seltzermen years ago. We use the same bottles over and over and over.
And not just old-fashioned. They're old.
They're old. They're some of the bottles are about 100 years old. You know, you pick up any bottle, it says the year on it. We have a lot of 30s, 40s, 50s. I think they stopped making them in like the 60s, early 60s.
You kind of led this rebrand of Gomberg Seltzer Works into Brooklyn Seltzer Boys. What was like the idea behind that? Why did you kind of take that direction?
Nobody really knew what Gomberg is. We wanted to create a separate company because we wanted to know that the business I'm starting is going to be able to stand on its own and not just like live off of, you know, the business that already existed, Gomberg. So we kind of had to start fresh, and I still partnered up with my dad and my uncle, who had a piece in this business also. We each own a third. We just wanted to create a new identity. And what's funny about it is that a lot of the customers that we get, they say, oh, I had seltzer years ago from Brooklyn Seltzer. No, you didn't, because Brooklyn Seltzer didn't exist. It started in 2012. It's just, this is where we are. We're in Brooklyn, and it is seltzer. It just makes sense, and people just think that we've been always here.
So how does a seltzer factory work? Like, what is the day in the life of working in a seltzer factory? What do you do at Brooklyn Seltzer Boys, I guess?
Okay, so what we do is we have our own trucks, and all of the bottles that we use have been passed down from, you know, generation to generation. Many different seltzer men, they all originally had their own bottles and whatnot. They kind of all trickle down to us. So when we get in, we have a filler. His name is Tony. He comes in and he fills in whatever we need for the day. So the bottles get filled, and you came to our museum. You saw the way the machine works. It's a Barnett & Foster siphon filling machine. It was, I believe we got it from London from the early 1900s. So we're talking about century-old equipment here. All of the equipment is century-old. And the bottles get filled. Then they get loaded into the trucks. The drivers will drive and make deliveries to whoever's you know, whoever we route for that day. Alongside that happening, we also have a bottle fixing station. We constantly have to keep up with the upkeep of these bottles. I mean, we have to replace different parts and make sure that everything's working properly because people are paying a premium for the seltzer. We want to make sure it works. So they're either cleaning the bottles, fixing the bottles, and there's just a constant rotation of fixing, filling, loading, delivering. And then the seltzerman who's delivering those case of 10 bottles, they pick up an empty case. So very similar to the milkman style of business. We deliver a case of 10, we pick up the empties, and then they just constantly get circulated over and over.
And where does the seltzer come from?
Oh, let's go to that. So the seltzer is simply water and CO2. The water we get is New York City water, which we know is very good water. Many residents in New York City drink it from tap. We then take that water and we triple filter it through sand, charcoal, and paper. We've been doing it this way for forever. We want to make sure that the already clean water is even cleaner. Supposedly, and we do this on our tours, we tell everybody that there are these baby microscopic crustaceans in the water, these baby little shrimp that make the water unkosher. The triple filtration takes care of that. So now that we have our clean water, it gets filtered, then it gets chilled. We want to make sure we have cold water. Then it gets carbonated. We introduce CO2 into the water in a carbonator. And then from the carbonator, it goes into the bottling process or our machine. And the bottles are then placed upside down inside our machine. They rotate around this carousel. One time around, the bottle's filled, and it goes right back into the wood seltzer box.
Have people said that New York City seltzer is better than other seltzer because of the water? Is that something that you can taste like with bagels?
I mean, I've just been told. I don't go around drinking water in other, you know, states or anything.
New York City seltzer purist.
New York water is, it's just good water. And you hear all these stories about these companies in Florida and, you know, all over shipping water from New York to make their bagels or pizza better. I mean, it's a thing. People actually do it, and they pay for truckloads of water because it's from New York. So whether it's real or not, I mean, people are doing it. So we definitely pride ourselves on having good water and you know, making sure it's clean. One of the reasons we were in a location in Canarsie for about 70 years, and we moved during the pandemic. One of the reasons we stayed in Brooklyn was for the water. We wanted to make sure that nothing changed in the entire process. We could have gone to New Jersey, which is where I live. Don't love that commute, but it is what it is. And also, a lot of our customers are in New York City, so it just makes sense that we're here anyway.
What's the farthest that you deliver seltzer to?
Right now,
yeah,
we have a Suffolk route where we're going out pretty far.
Out on Long Island.
I think Long Island and in Jersey, we go as far south as Asbury Park. So I think we're about 50-mile radius.
Great pinball museum there.
In Asbury Park?
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. On the boardwalk. Fantastic.
Yeah. So we've kind of spread out a little more and more. And when I got in the business, I know I'm jumping all over, but when I got in the business, there were about 12 seltzermen, right? And when we started delivering, I didn't really want to go into their areas of delivery because they all had their little zones, and I didn't want to take away business from them. Plus, they're coming to us to have their bottles filled. I'm not looking to take over their business. So we really just promoted more towards restaurants and bars. As those seltzermen were getting out of the business, taking over those routes, I started taking all these areas. So most recently, I took over Long Island. I have one of the seltzermen, unfortunately, passed away. He was in Jersey. I took all of his Jersey routes. Rockland County, he had a route there. Most recently, I'm in the process of taking over another route in Brooklyn. There's only two guys left other than me, independent seltzermen that come in, that have their own bottles, and you know, we fill them, and they have their own businesses, their own trucks, and their own customers.
And am I right, they're all twice your age?
They're all more than twice my age. I think Walter has got to be in his 70s at this point, and Larry has got to be in he's about 70 as well.
So that means Alex is the future of seltzer.
I think in your book you say I'm the youngest seltzerman in the world, right?
That's right.
And Barry would know. He's the seltzer historian.
And you still are. It was true 10 years ago. It's still true today.
No, Aiden is. Didn't Aiden say he's a seltzer man now? My son?
Oh, we'll talk about Aiden.
We'll discuss that.
I love Aiden.
We'll talk about that.
I can't love Aiden.
So are you trying to train other people to be seltzer men, or are you just know it's going to be you?
Well, I know. Well, listen, I don't make all the deliveries anymore. I'm really in the office running the show. I have, you know, a couple of drivers that are still doing it, and you know, yes, I'm training them to be proper seltzermen. We haven't changed the style of business much, other than the fact that we take a credit card and we have a website, which is like unheard of in the seltzer world. You know, seltzermen are very much pen and paper, word of mouth kind of business.
I'm laughing. I'll say it because I'm laughing at you. I'm remembering the 7 hours I spent with Walter, who you just mentioned. Which was one of the most amazing 7 hours of my life. And looking at his list of who his clients were, I don't know how you would decode this. It was some kind of, you know, remarkable language he'd made up with pages and pages. And Eli was the same, who passed away, who was the oldest one in the country. And his papers in his car, it was just his car, was his office.
You're talking about the route cards?
Yeah.
Oy, oy, oy. And when I took over all these businesses, you know, I bought them from them. I had to decipher these coding, you know, situations, and they literally have like little route cards with the customer's name and the address, sometimes only first name, like, you know, Joan at, you know, 428 4th Street or something.
We should put one in a museum. We should do one.
It's hard to read because Eli, Eli, after a certain time, how old was Eli when he passed away? 83 or something. I took over the route with him, and that was a really cool story. So I took over his route, and I look at his route cards, and, you know, he got shaky as the years went on, and it's like chicken scratch. It's hard to read. But what's really cool about Eli, and Eli had a book written about him, children's book was The Seltzerman by Ken Rush, who was a customer of his. And when I took over Eli's route, that was the coolest thing, because at that point I think he was like the most famous seltzerman at the time. It was very important to him, because he's been delivering such a long time, that he introduced me to his customers. Right. So he took me on the route with him a couple, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days, and introduced me to all of his customers. A lot of his customers met him downstairs because he couldn't carry the cases anymore. They were so heavy. They came downstairs to switch it at his truck. It was crazy. So, but, you know, I took it into their apartments, and, you know, we were sitting down for a glass of seltzer. He would climb up the stairs. He'd be out of breath and sit down at the table, and they would serve him a glass of seltzer, and they would just be kibitzing, talking.
And am I right? They all would tell you how much they loved Eli.
Oh, my God.
And their kids and their grandparents used to buy from Eli.
Yeah, it was generation. I mean, he served people for, three generations. He knew grandchildren, and he went to bar and bat mitzvahs. And
those relationships that were formed between the seltzer men and the people who delivered to was so beautiful, and getting to travel with them and see that is amazing. And so getting to be connected with you, Alex, as you're maintaining those kind of relationships is so beautiful. And then getting to document them within the museum so other people can see, oh, this is still going on, is just remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we do have a nice relationship with a lot of our, you know, original customers. Unfortunately, there's so many now, I can't speak to every single one of them. We now have like a text, you know, messaging system that goes out. I can't call every customer for every delivery like Eli did. You know, Eli called all of his customers, hey, I'm coming tomorrow. And, you know, the conversation might be 30 minutes. I don't have that kind of time.
When Eli would walk with you, probably with the customers, he would say, "Sell this is not the product. It's me. Eli's the product. Right. It's Eli." Which is to say, it's all about the relationship he was building.
It is.
Using seltzer.
Right. And to that, when we took over the route, some of the customers were like, I was really only just doing it because of Eli. So I was like, okay, you know, that's fine. It was really nice to take over his route. And Steve Levine, which is another seltzerman, you know, at some point in the future, I'm sure if Walter's kids don't do it, I'll take over his too, and, you know, have everything. But listen, at the end of the day, it's still a small business in relation to like a Coca-Cola, Pepsi. It is more of that intimate, you know, we still speak to all of our customers, whether it's, you know, through email or text or, you know, phone call. I still have the customers that just, even though I send out a text, they don't text me back. They call me because they want to just make sure, hey, Alex, the bottles are going to be outside. The check is going to be in the box. I'll make it out to Brooklyn Seltzer, and there'll be a $5 tip. I have messages on my phone that just go on and on about the same thing every single time. I keep them in my phone because I love them so much.
So people still do that. They will leave these expensive 100-year-old glass bottles in these beautiful wooden crates right outside for you to pick up. Mm-hmm. And will you drop them off the same way? You'll drop off these now full, even more expensive, seltzer-filled glass 100-year-old siphon bottles where anyone can pick them up, but this trust relationship is still there where they're going to get them and you'll get them back?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain areas, you know, if it's not like if they're, you know, entrance to the house is on the main street, and you know they don't feel comfortable leaving the bottles there. You know, that's okay. But most people have like a side, you know, side of the house or under the stoop or in the vestibule. We have some keys and codes to people's houses. We take it in. Some customers, we bring it inside their kitchen, even though they're not home. And, you know, the dog comes and greets the seltzer man, and they put a bottle in the refrigerator so that it's cold when they get home. You know, we have a lot of different – you have to learn the route once you're on the route to know, you know, everybody's needs and where they want the bottles, because the whole part of the service is – we want to leave the bottles exactly where they're going to be stored in the house. You know, we do the schlepping. You don't have to do that. That's the fun about all this. You know, there's a lot of different ways we deal with customers, and we're going to keep doing it as long as we can.
Yeah, that's so unique, especially in this modern day, like Amazon and shipping and having no interaction with the people who are delivering the things you order.
Right, and especially during COVID. I mean, that, you know, I don't think we were done, but we lost a lot of business because all the bars and restaurants closed. Well, what are people looking for at this point when they don't want to go out into the world and go shopping? They want a home delivery service. So we didn't change anything. We do exactly that. We take it exactly to where the bottles need to be, you know, and make sure they're, you know, sanitized, clean, and whatnot. We had to invest in this very expensive commercial dishwasher to make sure that the bottles were sanitized properly. Before that, we were washing all the bottles by hand. That might not have been so acceptable COVID times, but we strive to make sure we have a clean product for everybody to use.
And then seltzer has a 15,000-year history, right? 1,500?
1,500
year history.
That's right.
Which you write about in your book, which you two met while you were writing your book, Barry, right?
Yeah, there was no way to write this book without discovering the Gomburg family. I mean, it was incredible to start this process of trying to understand this culture that Alex is talking about right now. I imagine for many of your listeners who did not know about growing up having seltzer delivered, maybe when they heard you're talking with people about seltzer, they might be thinking about White Claw. They might be thinking about LaCroix with flavored seltzer. But it isn't just about the product. You can hear there's a culture connected with those relationships with a local business, with a family, sometimes over generations, and having this locally made, locally produced product. I didn't know any of this when I started. All I knew was that I wanted a Soda Stream. It had just come to the U.S. in 2004. In fact, it was called Soda Club at the time. And I thought if I could write a review in a newspaper, I could get a free reviewer copy, which I did, which was great. And I thought that would be the end of the story. But when that piece came out, this tiny, tiny review, so many people were excited to share their own stories that someone suggested, you know what, there might be a book in this. I'd never written a book before, and I could barely write the article because there was nowhere to go to find out more about seltzer. There was no websites about seltzer. There was no other books about seltzer, even academic papers. There were the kind of research on carbonation, but I wanted to know about this culture. So when I started investigating who can I talk to learn about seltzer, very quickly the Gomburg family appeared, especially Alex's dad, Kenny. Alex at the time had not started building the business. It was about 8 or so years away, but I took a long time to get the book off the ground, trying to figure out what the story was. So by the time I really understood what the core of the book would be about, following the story of one new seltzer man in Pittsburgh who picked up a 120-year-old seltzer business, that I then was able to start talking with people who are in the business locally here where I live in New York City. And that's where I met Kenny. And once I met Kenny, he became such a key resource for me for the book. He appears throughout the book because he has that history. And then by the time the book was almost done, his son was getting into the business. So if you read my book, Seltzertopia, you'll see the epilogue is about the future of seltzer, which is really asking the question, is there a future for seltzer? And with someone like Alex, the answer was, yes, of course. Look at what Kenny's son is doing, the newest and youngest seltzer man in the country. And so through the connection with Kenny and then with Alex, I feel so grateful to be connected with the Gomburg family to tell a little bit of their story in the book, which in many ways is what Seltzertopia is about. It's not my story. It's the story of the seltzer men that Alex has been talking about Walter and Eli and about the customers for generations who were buying it and receiving it and being part of what it meant to be part of that cycle of the bottles coming and going and coming and going and the kids getting older and moving out of the house. So that when my book came out in 2018, I was so excited that the business was still going. He'd done it. Like, it wasn't just like a 1 or 2 year thing. It had now been, you know, 6 or 7 years into it. So when I did my first reading, remember that, in Manhattan? And you were there making egg creams. You were there with your palette of the bottles And you were making, which are always my favorite egg creams that I can have anywhere else. And so we kept running into each other because now that he's promoting his business, I'm promoting my book. Every once in a while, people would bring us together, whether it was at a talk or news. So, of course, when Alex told me during COVID that his dad and his uncle had decided it was time to retire, and that meant in part closing the business that had physically been in Canarsie since 1953, which I documented in the book with photos and I wrote about it, and if they were making something new, anything new in this space is, you know, the front page news because no one's doing new stuff. So you made a new space, and it's all, still in Brooklyn. Fantastic. But you've designed it from scratch. You built everything. You rebuilt, quote unquote, the line, how all the water comes in, how it becomes seltzer, how the liquid CO2 comes in, like everything. And physically built it out. They don't hire as many people. They do it themselves. They're so handy. Of course I wanted to come see it. So as soon as the pandemic had retreated enough and I can come visit it, I was just blown away walking into this space. At the time, it was this beautiful, white, long hallway. That's enormous because it had to be big enough for the seltzer trucks to drive in. And after you get through this long hallway in the back, you turn the corner and there it is revealed. It's the machinery. And you're like, what are these wires and what are these tubes and what is it all? How is it connected? And if it's running, then it's loud and there's water spurting everywhere. It's just so exciting. And what amazed me wasn't just the machines at the end, but the entrance walking in. The entrance to the left was just a wall. And on the other side of that was Alex's offices. But on the right was kind of like, what do you call those metal structures?
Well, like pallet racks, you mean?
Yeah, like pallet racks, right? Things for the work. But they actually look like museum exhibit spaces. And on top of it were, you know, storage items that he needed, like for materials for like boxes,
you know,
or something.
We keep bottles, you know, up there that we're probably never going to use. I have enough for my lifetime. I always say I'm trying to collect for my son.
But underneath it in each one,
right,
were the same types of machines you would see in the factory, but it was just other copies. But now that you're looking at these machines that are like 50, 80, 100 plus years old, mm-hmm. they looked beautiful. And then there were wrenches that were lined on the wall. It was like he was decorating his home. It was just gorgeous. And he also started telling me that he was having some young people come in. You know, he mentioned that, yeah, there were tours that sometimes would happen, but there were also elementary schools that would come in and they would take the siphons apart, learn how to put them together, fill them with seltzer. I'm like, you're doing educational programming and you've designed this kind of artistic display of old machines. Have you thought about doing a museum? And as I often say, people, when I saw it and we talked about it, it was museum at first sight. Because he was like, yeah, that sounds interesting. And one of the things I love about being connected with both the Gomberg family and specifically Alex is he has 1,000 ideas. So when he heard the idea of a museum, he can speak for himself, but it seemed like to me it was a new thing for him to say, oh, what crazy thing can we do now? And he knows me. I love to have crazy ideas. And with my background in experience design, in museums, and having spent at this point now 20 years writing about seltzer, the two of us together knew that story. We knew the science of it. We knew the history of it as a business. We knew the technology, and we knew the culture. And he had the space. And I will always be so appreciative that he was willing to say, I'm willing to take our current space, which is an active live factory, and let's put a museum layer on top of it. And we'll figure it out along the way, one step at a time. And we're now a year into the soft launch, and it's been that nonstop. He has crazy ideas. I build on them. I have crazy ideas. He builds on them. And together, each month, we're figuring out what does it mean to make a new cultural institution around seltzer that's about the history of seltzer, the culture of seltzer in the world, in New York, about the technology, about the science, but do it in a place that's a live factory where you can come in and see it happen. But it's not written in stone. Each month, we're figuring out what do we do next? How do we engage people here? How do we help a 2-year-old have fun? How do we help a 92-year-old have fun? And it's an adventure every day.
Right. And not all the ideas are ours. We get people that come in and say, you know, I want to have a dinner party here because I create, you know, Shabbat dinners or something in different interesting spaces. And they want to rent, you know, just like a factory and host like a party. Okay.
Or I like to have an art gallery. I'm going to make original seltzer art and I want to sell it through the museum on the wall and we'll have an event and they'll run the event and we'll have it up there for a month.
Right. We did that. One of my customers, Meredith McNeil, made all these paintings, about a dozen or 15 paintings, and we posted them on the wall and we had a really nice gala event where she invited all her students and friends and, you know, try to sell some paintings.
People said they want to do a rave party. People said they want to do some kind of, you know, taster mixology event. People said they want to do a street party where people are going to be, you know, throwing seltzer balloons at each other. I mean, people just have all sorts of ideas, and tell them to us. Come to us. Let us know how you want to use the space, how we can work together to activate it and bring people from all around New York to the Brooklyn Seltzer Museum.
Right, because these bottles are just so just the visual like look of it, it just attracts attention. You know, somebody not necessarily may not know what it is, but it just creates this like allure. I want to see what that is. What does it do? I want to spray it. I want to feel it. I want to touch it. You know, stuff like that.
They're pink. They're green. Yeah. They're blue. They're yellow. Some glow in the dark.
Yeah. So there's just – and some are little baby bottles. Yeah. We have larger bottles. And
are those called send-ups from hotels?
Those are called send-ups, the little 7-ounce bottles.
They look like
bottles.
Little mini baby siphons. And what Alex will do is work with young people on a table. They get little soda jerk hats, and they'll get a bottle of Ubetz chocolate syrup on the table, and, of course, some cold milk, the cups and the mixing, and the seltzer so they can make their own egg creams, which, if you don't know, is seltzer, cold milk, and chocolate syrup, usually Ubetz. But he gives them these little tiny bottles, so it's the children's size bottles. And they were meant for hotels where people would have them come up to their room to mix a drink. They're really tiny. They look so cute when the little kids are making egg creams with them.
So cute. Yeah. I got that idea from my kids' school. They asked me, can you do a show and tell like of what you do? So I brought it in, and the kids went crazy. They went cuckoo. So since I've done it for all my kids, and I've done it for my nephew, I bring into the class, and they don't know what an egg cream is. They don't know what they – you know, there's no eggs, there's no cream and egg cream, but they just like to spray it. They like to feel it. It's just like a new little thing, an experiment. And then I go to the class and I read the children's book, Eli the Seltzerman. It's a cute little thing that I bring to the class.
And
it's
love bringing the classes into the museum.
We
are a place that if you're a school teacher in New York City, kindergarten up through 6, maybe even middle school, come on by. We're part of the whole system in the city to go visit cultural events, and we'd love to host you for a few hours.
And it's so unique that you have it in an active factory. Like, how do you navigate that with having the work be done but also having groups come in?
Yeah, that is a little bit of the challenge. But we knew kind of that going in. We have to close the factory in order to host anybody there. It just we want to create a safe space for everybody when they're there.
And closing it means what?
Closing it means that we shouldn't have any trucks coming in and out of the building. Because what we do is the Seltzermen, they would come. And they would back into our building and load in our basically loading area. That's like basically our museum area. So we can't have any seltzermen going in. We can't have any seltzer going out. We can't load our trucks. That doesn't mean we can't still do what we need to do inside the factory. Tony could still fill bottles. We just purchased a long, you know, rope to make sure that nobody gets too close or, you know, anything like that.
So the factory can still be running.
The factory can still be running. Nothing's going in and out of the doors, you know?
But you can see the seltzer being filled.
You can definitely. Anything you need to see visually, you could still see.
So as the co-founder and co-curator with Alex of the museum, I have nothing to do with the business, but of the museum, I'm so fortunate that they figured out how to keep so much of it alive so people can come in and see it. I mean, I think about factory tours for me, Ben and Jerry's factory in Vermont or the Mint in Philadelphia. You're always in this, you know, self-contained hallway with glass looking at the actual factory. You're not really in the factory. When you come to the Brooklyn Seltzer Museum, you're in the Brooklyn Seltzer Boys factory. You're a few feet away from the machines. You can get sprayed in the face with the water that's coming out of them. And in fact, you get to spray the bottles. You get to take the siphon and spray them at your friend, at yourself. You can drink from it. I mean, I would think it's probably the most popular thing people do.
What, the spritzing station?
Yeah.
Oh, that's my favorite. Because what we did was we set up along the conveyor belt. We have this little, you know, plexiglass, and we don't even tell anybody what we're doing at that time. We don't really advertise that we do it. We have somebody with their phone come behind, and I think you did this too when you were at the museum.
I don't know if the glass was there.
It wasn't.
Yeah, we kind of you know revise it as
we
go.
We had to get there. I can talk about that after.
And we're not even where I would like it to be. I want a whole booth. But anyway, right now the way we have it is we have this plexiglass hanging from this. We have a whole Kindorf system. Somebody gets behind the plexiglass, and we set up a little, you know, stage area where somebody takes a bottle and they'll spray it at the glass. Meanwhile, the person behind the glass has their phone. I usually tell them to put in slow-mo because I just think it's the coolest thing. They put it in slow-mo, and they get this gush of water just rushing at their face, and it's the coolest video, right? So they get to spray the bottle. They get to, you know, they shake it and spray it, and it's just – so much fun to watch their faces light up as they're like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing, you know?
And that's such a great example of why I love working with Alex and why I love getting to work on this project, because we really have the space and time to do it right. Mm-hmm. What we had at the beginning, which I should say, let me step back a moment, we worked with graduate students at NYU and at Teachers College Columbia to build out most of the exhibits and kind of figure out how to activate the space. That's why we can have 3D models you can manipulate, and we have a treasure hunt that was originally on paper but now is also digital, and so many other things. But one group made worked with Kenny, Alex's dad, to make a stand that we would stick a full siphon in, and there was a sign that would explain, go ahead and spray it in your mouth. And there were glasses people could wear so that, you know, goggles so that no one would hurt themselves. But the focus was on spraying it to yourself and spraying it in your mouth. And you'd have to read a sign, right? So it was unfacilitated. So that's how it started. And what we saw over time is that some people like to do that, but some people like to spray each other. And now it's just getting everywhere. And
That's what we do when we went. And I missed Jessie's mouth. So it may be one of the best videos of me spraying her in the neck.
That's so funny.
And then I just like slowed it down and then we just watched it on repeat.
Oh, I didn't tell you this. You know what's even funnier?
What's that?
Somebody came the other day for a tour and was like, I literally came to get sprayed. Hmm. So I was like, nah, you're kidding, right? He says, no, spray me. It's like, you got to be out of your mind. He says, no, the whole bottle. So he stood there and took it like a man, and I sprayed the entire bottle, doused him in seltzer. And he was like, that just made my day.
That's great.
Like, so we summertime's coming. This is what we got to do.
Seltzer field day.
Come on, Barry.
That's right.
Like seltzer field day.
That's what we want to do. That's what we want to figure out how to do that.
Right now we do the tours on Fridays, right? So we know that we have a tour every Friday. You know, the general public can buy tickets online and they can buy it. But what we'd really like to do, and what we've been doing really, is once a month we have like an event, a main event, you know, what it is. And we have usually on a weekend, on a Saturday or a Sunday. We had kids events. We had
the Seltzer family party. The family Seltzer party. We did Open House New York last November. And Jane, you came in March. It was National Egg Cream Day, which we're not responsible for, but said we got to do something with National Egg Cream Day.
Right.
And we had the 2024 National Egg Cream Invitational.
Right.
That was, again, like, what are we going to do this day? We kept iterating ideas till we landed on this one. Let's bring restaurants in, local restaurants, to mix egg creams and compete to have the best egg cream of 2024 and have judges like Jane there to say, this is the best egg cream. This is the best tasting, best performance, best presentation. And one of those judges, of course, was, segue to,
Aiden Gomberg.
Aiden. Our fourth grader? Fifth grader?
He's a fourth grader going
fourth
into fifth
grader.
Grade. Going into middle school.
And if you're lucky, if you come to an event at the museum on the weekend.
On a weekend, yeah.
Aiden will be there mixing the egg creams. He has the Aiden special.
He loves making egg creams.
Oh, he's making them now? Is he going to be in the Invitational next year?
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe we'll have the kid
Who's going to not say he has the best?
He loves it.
I will say, at the Invitational, because I tried all the egg creams, my favorite one was the one made by the house afterwards.
Oh, that's funny.
Chris.
By Chris? Okay.
Yeah, I got a strawberry one.
Okay.
Wow. Which I was like, don't tell anyone, I think this was the best one I had.
So let's turn the tables for a moment. What was it like for you to come be in an event at the Brooklyn Seltzer Museum? What was it like to be a judge at the Egg Cream Invitational?
It was very exciting. It was sold out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was packed. Everyone seemed very excited. Everyone seemed more knowledgeable on egg creams than I was.
That was the event. Like, if you go to Comic-Con, people know comics. Like, this is – everyone knew egg creams. And what was crazy, just leading up to the event, it was really invitation only. And then we had a couple spaces left. We were like, we could hold this many people in our building, right?
Like, yeah, I think we added like 25 tickets.
So we added 25 tickets. They were sold in what?
Within days. Yeah.
In a day. Yeah. And there were people calling saying, oh, please, I'm in town. I'm only here for this. And I really want to come to this event. We let a couple people slide. But then I think if we kept it open, it would have been another 100 people easy.
Yeah.
Having all the soda drinks, and they have their own like very unique community that for me didn't even know it was a thing. Just seeing how niche and excited people were about egg creams.
I also underestimated the power of that community. I knew they loved egg creams. For some, they said that's why we made the business. But the connections between them, I had no idea was kind of a thing under the surface. I think Pete from Pharmacy in Cobble Hills in Brooklyn said, it's like you're on an island when you're making an egg cream because you're doing it in your own business. You don't see everyone else. And one of our judges says, you can't compare them. The egg cream's only good for a few minutes. It's highly carbonated and the carbonation's dying as soon as it's mixed. So you have like 2 or 3 minutes to drink at tops. So you can't go from business to business and taste them. So for both of them, whether they were the egg cream lovers or the egg cream makers, they never got to be around so many egg creams mm-hmm. being made at the same time. And we didn't realize, I certainly don't think I didn't, and Alex maybe not the same, that bringing them together itself was almost like doing good for their community and how energizing it was going to be for them. And that energy came out in everything that they did.
Oh, for sure.
So those are the kind of events we're doing. Like, what's the next big thing we're going to do? We don't know. We're trying to figure it out.
Seltzer Field Day.
So what? Let's talk about it. What's Seltzer Field Day going to be?
Well, we can't have it in our place. I think it's too small.
Too small. And it's going to be too high. It's going to be somewhere.
Do it on the street.
Right?
Do it on the street.
Okay, so
it's on the street.
In the street. All right. So what happens in the street? What happens at a Seltzer Field Day? I want to carry something that I can drop without it breaking.
Maybe you're just going to put a lot of bubble wrap around the bottle before
you
let
probably. Them. Probably. Well, I was telling you, I'm saying it right here. What I want to do is make the world's largest egg cream.
Whoa.
Like literally like a 20-gallon like vessel and then have, you know, however many people squirting the UBET into it up to a certain point and then have like a milk truck come with all old-fashioned milk bottles, pour it in, and then have like 20 guys spraying seltzer into it. And it's not even going to be filled. You're going to have to fill it constantly and have a pretzel company make the world's biggest pretzel
largest
and stir it
pretzel.
With a pretzel stick or something like that. I would love
How
to do
large do
like
we
that.
Think this is?
I don't know. What's the Guinness Book of World Record for the largest egg cream?
Well, I know we'll need two things. We'll need a sponsor and we'll need a way to siphon out the egg cream so we can give it to people to drink. You can't stick 1,000 straws in, right? That wouldn't be sanitary.
Spouts all around.
Spouts. There you go. Yeah, so we need a device which you guys can build, I'm sure, with all the spouts, and people come up with their cup, get their egg creams. That would be amazing.
We'll figure it out. We can do it.
Now I'm just thinking, like, is it just like the size of this table, or is it the size
of
a
trunk? Oh, no, it's
like
bigger.
Alex's
vision's bigger.
You're going to have to get on a ladder to fill the cup.
Yeah,
sure.
How many ladders do we need?
I don't know. We're going to need a ladder company to sponsor getting us up there.
Like, do we need a really big bottle of seltzer? Do you
all the bottles. Just keep squirting them in.
People can just line up with their siphon to spritz it.
Yeah.
Bring it back. Get it refilled. We'll have like a line of people. It'll be like a old, you know, 1950s cartoon.
That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah.
It's so fun. And it's so fun. And I appreciate, especially during today's such challenging times, having something just makes people happy. People who are like the older generations, it's just they're awash in nostalgia when they come. For younger generations, they don't even know what this is about. They know there's something about seltzer. How quirky. Let's check it out. And it's just so effervescent. It's just so fun and light and playful. And you get to see the kind of things we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast. Those relationships between Alex and his company and the customers, those aren't just in the background. We put them to the foreground. We have a customer storybook, and that's what we call it, right? And each page in the storybook, one side is a customer saying what it means for them to get seltzer from the Brooklyn Seltzer Boys. And then the flip side of it is Alex talking about his relationship with the customer. So every page is a document of those relationships. So we're inviting people to come in and explore those relationships. We put it right in people's faces and say, this is a really special thing. Seltzer itself is special. What we choose to do and connect with seltzer is special. And what it means to have a family business that goes back four generations is special. We wrap it all into one package and everyone just leaves with a smile on their face.
So they can visit the Brooklyn Seltzer Museum on Fridays, right?
Right.
And if they can't come on Fridays, we have much of it online. We have the virtual Seltzer Museum. So when you come to the BrooklynSeltzerMuseum.org, there's a whole virtual section where we've reproduced digitally the physical puzzles that we give people. You can do them online. There's the timelines that you referenced, Jane, that goes back, you know, back before 0 BC. And you can explore all of that. You can leave your own memories and read other people's memories on the Seltzer Memory Wall. And we're going to continually add new aspects to that as well.
Right, but they could, if anyone wants to physically come, they could buy tickets on our website, BrooklynSeltzerMuseum.org. They could purchase as many tickets as they want. And then we also do offer an option to have your own private tour, like say on a weekend. So that is a phone call, you know, that you can get our number on the website.
We push out new content all the time on Instagram and on Facebook. And when we're lucky to meet people like Jane on TikTok.
And Jane, thank you very much for your TikTok video, which are thousands and thousands of views. It was amazing.
The New York Times got us email followers. You got us visitors in the
door. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
for sure.
Yay.
Definitely. I mean, they came out at a nice time because it was right before one of our events. And we sold quite a bit of tickets off that TikTok. So it was really great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm glad. So is there anything else you want to share before we wrap this up?
I just appreciate that you're taking to the mic. I love that you're doing podcasts. I've been doing podcasts myself for 20 years, and I love that you've had an impact in the museum space. You're helping bring people into museums, into exhibits, think about them and experience them in new ways. And I'm excited for what you're going to do now in the podcast space.
Oh, thank you. So This has been The Next Stop Is with me, Jane August. You can find me at Jane August on TikTok and Instagram. If you like the podcast, give us a review, because if TikTok gets banned, this might be all I have. See you next time. The Next Stop Is, it's recorded at Brick House in downtown Brooklyn. It premieres on Brooklyn Free Speech Radio and can be found wherever you listen to podcasts.